let us start. So this is the last lecture, and hopefully if we have time, we will triumph and we will calculate critical exponents. If not, we will do it in tutorial, so don't worry, you will not miss it. But anyway, so let me briefly recapitulate what we have done yesterday, and then I introduced this idea of renormalization. And basically the whole idea, although very fancy, is about that I split my integration for my partition function, which is in general an integral over d phi, and then e to the s, which depends on this phi. But I split it into two parts. I basically consider modes, which are fast modes here, which means that their momenta is bigger than something. And then the modes, which are slow modes, which means that their momenta is smaller than something. And then I try to do this integral in parts. So I always integrate only over fast modes, postponing doing the integral for the slow modes as long as I can. And in the end, I realize that actually I don't have to do it. So this is a really nice trick how to avoid any problems. You just do something which you can do, and in the end, you may be lucky and you don't have to do something you cannot do. Okay. So this is the idea. So basically, I split the integration over fast modes and the slow modes. And this is my action, which is the action for a scalar field, phi to the fourth theory of scalar field. However, in imaginary time, so you will learn probably next week in QFT2 that immediately when I have imaginary time, its periodicity is connected to the temperature. So the fact that we have imaginary time actually tells us that we are describing statistical system at finite temperature. But you will see that explicitly next week. So anyway, so the idea is to integrate these over these fast modes and obtain something which is only an integral over the slow modes, but of some new action S tilde. Okay. So now, the first step of the renormalization is to really find this what this S tilde is explicitly. So on one hand, you know that this S tilde must have exactly the same functional form as the action you started with. Simply, even if you generate new terms and whatsoever, they do not contribute because they are irrelevant. So in the end, what I have to have is this type of the action. And what can possibly only happen is that I actually have new coupling constants. So let's call them R2 tilde, R0 tilde, and R4 tilde. Okay, so that's the only thing that can happen. But based on symmetry, based on the fact that everything else is irrelevant, I must have this form. Okay, so now, of course, the dirty part of your job is to actually calculate this explicitly. You need to calculate what this R tilde 2 is, what this R0 tilde is, and what this R4 tilde is. And so the way how you do it is that you do it perturbatively, but the perturbation is, you know, slightly different than you might think. It's actually an expansion around small epsilon, which is d-4 epsilon. Okay, so now comparing the left-hand side here and the right-hand side here, you know that this S tilde for slow modes actually have to have this form where I already expanded using this Comulan expansion. So I have the non-interacting part just simply evaluated at slow modes. And then I have the average over the fast modes of S interacting, which would be like my first order approximation. And then if you go to second order, I have to include squares of S interacting and so on. So you would have many, many corrections. Okay. So now if I just want to calculate this to the first order, which is what we have done yesterday, this is actually quite simple. So to the first order, you need to know what your S interacting is. And we have introduced these nice pictures, the Feynman rules, actually how to calculate that. So we said that the slow modes will correspond to thick lines. And the fast modes will correspond to, say, dotted lines or dash dot lines. And the process of averaging actually tells me that I have to connect always two fast lines. Okay? So S interacting has all these possible terms. There are some factors which multiply these things. So either I have four slow modes, I have three and one fast, three fast, and one slow, and so on. So now if I want to average over this, so S interacting. So I'm connecting my fast modes, replacing them by the corresponding propagator and corresponding integration. So of course there is no fast mode here, so I just leave this guy as it were. Right. This I cannot do because I have only one fast mode and I cannot connect it with anything, so this gives me zero. Similarly here, if I connect two, I still have one left and it, you know, doesn't help me, so this gives me zero. This thing just gives me one bubble here, and then I have two external legs which correspond to slow modes, and this thing just gives me something like that, which if you think about it, definitely doesn't depend on slow mode, so it's just a number, okay? So now, if you remember our Feynman rules, then whenever I had a vortex, it was associated with U, right? So this just gives me the power which depends on my vortex U. This is just a number, so I don't care about that. And then you can basically read the result, what this must be. So I showed you explicitly what this is yesterday. But you know what it can be, right? So first of all, there is six of those. If you calculate how many of these diagrams you get. And so you have six times. Now there is one vortex here. So it's U over 4 factorial. U over 4 factorial. Then you have the integral over the propagator, which is something. It's some integral. Let's call it I. Okay. And then in the end, what you have is just two external legs. Okay. So that just gives me an integral over phi smaller k square. Okay. So this is what it is. And you can basically immediately write down the result for this type of diagram. So now, of course, in order to write as tilde, I have to sum this guy and that guy. So this guy is just whatever I had before. So is this R0, well, part. And then this as interacting gives me the interacting part, nothing changed here, plus this part. But if you look at this part, actually is exactly of the same type as zero, right? So what stands here actually corresponds to my constant R in S0. So from here, I can immediately read. So first of all, there's this R2 tilde. Nothing happened with that. Zero tilde was my original R plus something which has two external legs. And this is what it modifies. So it's plus U over 2 times I. And then at this level, nothing happened with U. So R4 tilde equals to U. And this is what I read in the first approximation. Okay. So that's step A, and that's really the calculational step where you have to do the calculation. So now step B we have done once and for all in this general discussion. So step B was to bring S tilde phi slow to the original form. Okay. So basically here I have integral from, let's say, 0 to lambda over beta. So in order to get, again, an integral from 0 to lambda, I have to rescale my momenta. But we have seen also that we have to rescale the wave function. Okay. So for this was achieved by saying that I have new momenta, k times beta, and that my new function, phi tilde, k tilde, equals to phi slow, beta to minus d plus 2 minus eta over 2. So I've shown you this explicitly yesterday. And so if you do this, you realize that you get exactly the same action as you started with coupling constants R and U, but now they change to R tilde and U tilde. Okay? So this is what happens with your action, but otherwise it's exactly the same action as you started with at the beginning. And then I also shown you that if I define my anomalous dimension in this way, so this is just a definition of eta, if you want, at this point. And at this point, it has nothing to do with the anomalous dimension, which you know from correlation function. Then the new coupling constant R tilde is equal to beta minus 2 eta 0 tilde, which I calculated here. And in the same way, if I want u tilde, this is equal to beta 4 minus 2 eta minus d times r4 tilde. Okay, so this is something I derived for you, and you know, you may take it for granted. So all you really have to do when you're calculating new things is to really calculate this thing explicitly. Because then once I find what my r0 tilde and r4 tilde are, then I know what my new couplings, how they actually look like. Okay? And so in so where we ended our calculation yesterday is that I showed you that because we have that, and in plugging it over there, we get the RG recursion relations that R tilde equals to beta square R plus U over 2 times some integral, and U tilde is to beta 4 minus D times U. And this is where we ended our class yesterday. That's called RG recursion. So, everybody happy with this, or more or less? So it's really just to do these two steps. But step B is done once and for all, and step A actually is where you have to do the actual calculation. Okay. So now this is all very nice, this recursion relation. So I really know how my new coupling constants at each step look in terms of the old coupling constants. But it's actually advantageous to rewrite it as a differential equation. Differential equation is much easier to deal with than an algebraic equation. So write this in differential equation form. And so the trick to do that is that you say, well, my beta, which is 1.1, whatever, is exponential of something small, exponential to delta L, where I treat delta L very, very small. Okay. So then, looking at this guy here, I have R tilde equals to, well, this thing here. So now beta square, what it is? It's 1 plus 2 delta L. So beta square is 1 plus 2 times delta L plus other terms. Okay. And what I have here is R plus U over 2. And then you have to remember what that integral was yesterday. And so let me write it. And I said, let's expand it already in small delta L. So it was equal to, if you look your notes, it's the volume of the sphere, 2 pi to power d, the cutoff to lambda to d, and then r plus lambda square, and then delta L. And then you would have, again, corrections, which are high order in delta L. Okay. So now, of course, I want to expand this to the first order in delta L. So I get that this is equal to r plus 2r delta L plus u over 2 as d 2 pi to power d lambda d r plus lambda square delta L. And plus other terms, which I don't care about. And so now we want to really, so you take r tilde minus r and divide everything by delta L, and you turn it to a differential equation. So I have that r tilde minus r delta L, which looks like a differential, right? So I define this to be dr over dl. And whatever is left on the right-hand side, so it's equal to 2 times r. And then that integral over there, so it's u over 2 as d 2 pi d lambda d r plus lambda square. Okay, so this is for the r. Similarly, much more simpler, it is for the u. So you would have that du over dl equals to 4 minus d times u. So this is a differential form of your RG recursion relations. Okay, everybody happy with this? It's very simple. So now, so this was for our specific example, but generally you would have relations like if I have a quantity x, I would have dx over dl equals to some function which depends on my beta x. Okay, so now this function is a famous function, and its own name. So I write beta because it's called beta function. So this is a beta function. I'll have all these relations, like my couplings change depending on L by given this beta function on the right-hand side. And of course, the fixed point will correspond to the fact when x doesn't change anymore under L, right? So then I will have beta x equal to 0. So fixed point corresponds to beta x equal to 0. Okay, so now notice one very interesting fact about our beta function. And this is actually this 2 here and this 4 minus d here. So if you remember our dimensional analysis, which we've done two lectures ago, then you probably remember that the dimensions of the coupling r is 2. And the dimension of coupling u is epsilon, which is 4 minus d. This is actually a general feature of your beta function. So always the first term of the beta function is the dimension of the coupling times the coupling. Okay, and we'll show that in your tutorial today. So in leading order, we have always the form that beta x equals to the dimension of that coupling times x plus other terms. Okay, so you'll see that in your tutorial. So what it actually means is that we could have written this and that immediately, and the only thing which is non-trivial in our calculation is this part here. Okay. So this is quite unsatisfactory, right? So we haven't learned anything here. The only thing which we learned is this part here. And to make it more satisfactory, you would like to make a correction to u. So you'd like to make another term here plus another term so that we have actually both terms corrected, not just the leading order, which we can immediately write down. Okay? So for that reason, so in order to get this term here, we need to go to the second order in our expansion. So really, we have to go to the S interacting square term, to the second cumulon, to get this correction over here. But again, we can almost immediately write down the result, right? So to get first correction to du over dl, and du over dl, so we need second cumulon, or second okay. So now you want the correction to u, And u has, so if you look at that action there, so u has actually four phis in it. So it's phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4, which must be slow modes. So in order to get correction to u, I need to have something which has four external slow legs, right? So no matter what happens inside, I have to have four external legs to get a correction to u, which contains four slow modes. Okay. So want, well, connected diagram. So diagram with four external slow legs. Okay. So now if you think about it, so now you are at the level S intersecting square. So you have this times that. Okay. So in total, you have eight things. And now we are interested only in those, which has four external slow legs. So one example, so for example, I have this thing here. And then I want to connect it to another thing over here. This is precisely the diagram which we actually want. So if I connect this guy here and this guy here, I create a diagram which looks like something like this. And it has precisely four external legs. You know, something interesting happens inside, but this is precisely what will correct my u. Okay? Well, for example, if I have something different, so let's say if I had 3 here and 1, and 3 here and 1, well, then I could connect this one here, and this one here. So I would have something like this. Okay, so this guy has only two external legs. So it wouldn't change my u, but it would change my r, right? Because that's something which has two external legs. So I definitely don't need this type of diagram.
What about one that's two solid properties? Like, what if the external things
are
solid
ones? Okay, very good question. Thank you for that. So you cannot do that because, remember, so how do we get the connections? It's an average over fast modes. So you can never connect slow modes together. Thank you for that question. Excellent question. Okay, so you know, this is one diagram I can draw. In fact, there is 36. If you calculate how many of those are there is 36 of these diagrams. You may think, well, another diagram which may be, for example, useful is diagram like that. So this guy has four external legs. Slow legs, and there's something happening inside. And there's 48 of those. But does this diagram contribute? What do you think? That's correct answer. It doesn't contribute. And the reason for that is that at each and every vertex, you have to conserve your total momentum. Okay? So if I want to conserve, for example, if I look at this guy here, I have three very fast modes and one very slow mode. So basically, I'm turning two fast modes into one fast and one slow. And actually, that's not possible. So just conservation of momentum tells you that this diagram doesn't contribute. And so you can try to draw various things and so on with four external legs. And in the end, you find out that this is the only diagram which contributes in the second order. Yes?
To consistently take care of the order, like why we neglect the second order cumulant contribution to the R?
Like Of course. If I want to have, but what it would give me another term here. Yeah, exactly.
I want to include the second order cumulant. Why we only include both order into the equation and not the second order?
It's a good question. It can be shown later that whatever you get here is you know of higher order than whatever you get here. So yeah, in principle you're absolutely right. I need to include the corrections to R as well. But it will turn out to be of higher order.
Higher order means higher order of
in epsilon.
Epsilon?
In epsilon. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now, if I have this diagram, again, you can immediately write down basically the result, right? So I have one vortex here and one vortex here. So the result must be proportional to u squared, right? And then there is something happening inside, which I call integral I2 or whatever, I tilde. And then in the end, I have four external legs. So we'll have an integration over k1 to k4 and phi1 to phi4 and so on. So this thing here is really a contribution to my u. Okay? So let me write down the result. So this part, which we already had, so this is my beta function because it corresponds to my coupling r. Let's call it beta r equals to 2r plus u over 2. Let me just put all the constants to kd. I will just define it later. R plus lambda square. And then du over dl is beta u. And this is epsilon times u minus 3 half u square, precisely as we expect. And there's another integral, which will be kd over r plus lambda square. And this kd, I just use it as a shortcut for sd over 2 pi d and lambda to d. So this is my RG relations. I get my beta function, and both of them are corrected to the first order, basically. So the first one I can just read from dimensional analysis, just dimension of the corresponding operator, but then I calculated the first correction to that. Okay. Questions? So now we have section 6. So now we have all these beta functions and everything, so we just have to analyze what it gives us. Right? So section 6 is fixed points. So fixed points means that beta r equals to 0 equal to beta u. So now if you stare at your expression on the right-hand side, you can immediately guess one fixed point. Can you tell me what it could be?
0, 0.
There you go. So there's actually two of them. So one fixed point r star u star equals to 0, 0, which you immediately see from the right-hand side. It's called Gaussian fixed point. And the other one, which is less trivial, well, in general, it's a very complicated algebraic equation to solve. But what I will do is I will assume that r close to the phase transition is small. So r is approximately 0. So then I will actually neglect r in the denominator. Or is it like r plus lambda squared? I will just throw away this r. And then you can solve it easily. And so what you obtain from here is that r star is minus epsilon over 6 lambda squared. Try with Mathematica or Maple or whatever. Convince yourself that this is true. And then lambda 4 kd and epsilon. No, but very good. I'm assuming that epsilon is small. So you are basically doing epsilon expansion. Yeah. So the definition of epsilon is 4 minus d. But you are doing small epsilon expansion. It's crazy, right? But anyway, you are doing that. And so this other point is called Wilson-Fisher. And so the calculation which we are actually doing, fixed point, it led to a Nobel Prize, right? So this is a Nobel Prize calculation. Okay. Okay. So you get this expression if you neglect that r in the denominator, and if you do like small epsilon expansion. So now, you know, if this fixed point were actually our critical point where the phase transition happens, so now I am, well, so let epsilon actually be bigger than zero now, which means that d minus four, so it's in dimensions which are smaller than four. And let's say that this is the right point. Then you immediately see that the value of r star is actually negative. Okay, so then the r star for the second one is negative. But r star is related to my critical temperature. It's t minus tc over tc. So what it tells you that if this fixed point were actually a true fixed point for d smaller than four, then the critical temperature would be lower than predicted by your mean field theory. Because you predicted mean field theory that r equals to zero. Now you are saying the critical temperature actually happens for some value which is smaller than zero. So which means that actually the true critical temperature is lower than predicted. Than predicted by mean field theory. And you know, this is very easy to understand if you think about what was doing. So now we are including fluctuations. And of course, fluctuations try to disorder your system, right? So more fluctuations I have, I don't want to create big blocks of equal spin, right? So this is, you know, the effect of fluctuations. Now I have taken the fluctuations into account. And that's why I have to lower temperature more to actually get a phase transition. This is an effect of fluctuations. And of course, it means that the ordering is more difficult. Okay. So that's just, as I said, well, let's assume that the second point is the right one. So let me now just prove it that the second point is the right one when you are in smaller dimensions than four. So we have to really, you know, do a very simple analysis of what each fixed point tells me. Okay. So let's start with the Gaussian fixed point. And you know that Gaussian fixed point has actually r star equal to zero, which is precisely what mean field theory predicted, r equals to zero, right? So that's why this call is sometimes also called mean field theory critical point. Okay, so now basically what you want to do is that you want to concentrate on the vicinity of your fixed point. So you want to expand your beta functions close to 0, 0, close to your fixed point. Okay, so let's linearize, right, my beta functions near this point. So what it means is that I tail expand my beta functions on the right hand side around 0, 0, right? So I define delta r to be r minus r star and delta u to be u minus u star. Of course, in our case, r star and u star equals to 0. So it's even simpler there. And then just convince yourself, but it probably is obvious, is that if I do the Taylor expansion, I can write it in matrix form. So I have d over delta r delta u, and equals to the first term will be just a constant matrix, d beta r over dr, d beta r over du, and then the other one, d beta u over dr, beta u over du times delta r delta u. Okay, so that's the first thing you can write down. And of course, you evaluate this guy at I equal to r star, and u equal to u star. So that's your linearization of the problem, right? You're just taking Taylor expansion. So if I plug r equal to r star and u equal to u star, and this is just a constant matrix. Let's call it M, and it's a constant matrix, right? So linear algebra. So now we do even more linear algebra. So when you have a matrix, I was told in the first year that the first thing you do is that you find eigenvectors and eigenvalues. If you do linear algebra, if you do analysis, the first thing you do, you differentiate, right? So that's the general rule. So let's find eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So of course you have to find this explicitly. So I know those explicit expressions, right? And I do this, these derivatives, and I plug r star equal to 0 and u star equal to 0. So if you do that, your matrix becomes, and again, use Mathematica or Maple to show that this is true. It's one line command, 2 lambda square. Unfortunately, you are not getting Nobel Prize for it. It's done already. So this is your matrix. So now if I want eigenvalues, this matrix, then I have determinant of M minus lambda times the unit matrix equals to 0. And that gives you 2 eigenvalues, lambda, let's call it lambda t equals to 2, and lambda 2, which I'll call lambda u tilde equals to epsilon. Okay, next step is to find eigenvectors. So the prescription is again M minus lambda times unit matrix. And this is my eigenvector V. And I have to solve this equation here. And from there, you find that the eigenvector corresponding to lambda t eigenvalue is just 1, 0. And the eigenvector corresponding to u tilde, so v u tilde, and I don't normalize them, I just put whatever mathematical Maple gives you. So 2 times epsilon minus 2 lambda square kd. By the way, this is precisely the calculation you are asked to do in your homework. So just make sure that you understand how to do this calculation. Okay, so we have found the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And of course, what they tell you is that, well, in the basis of these eigenvectors, you have diagonal matrix, right? So if I change from variables which are r and u to my new variables which are t and u tilde, my matrix is diagonal, and I can actually solve my beta function equation, right? So in new variables, t and u tilde, my matrix is diagonal, and exactly on the diagonal are my eigenvalues, right? It's a linear algebra. So dt over dl equals to lambda t times t, and du tilde over dl equals to lambda u tilde times u tilde, which is my matrix, right? Okay. But however, I can solve these equations, right? I can solve them because they are decoupled, they are linear equations. The solution is the exponential. Okay, so this gives me that t is some t zero e to lambda t times l, or for our case, it's t zero lambda t is just 2, so it's e to 2 l, and then u tilde equals to u0 e to lambda ul, which is u0 tilde e to epsilon l. Okay. I cannot write the blackboard, too bad. So now you know everything there is to know, and you can just plot whatever happens in your phase, in your space of coupling constants, right? So let me, and of course, you see that, that this epsilon, whether it's bigger or smaller than zero, something happens different, right? So either I actually go back or I flow away from my fixed point. Okay? So let's consider first an epsilon is smaller than zero, or in other words, I am in dimensions which are bigger than four. Okay? So if you do that, so let's plot my space of the couplings. So there is R, and there is U here. So now if you look at which directions my VT and the U tilde go, okay, so there's a fixed point at 0, 0, right? So this is my Gaussian fixed point here. And then I basically introduce new axis close to this fixed point. So the first one is the axis t. And if you look at that vt vector, it's just 1, 0. So it's precisely this direction is the direction of my t, right? So here I have that axis. On the other hand, vu tilde, so epsilon is smaller than 0. So it's 1 and something which is negative here. Okay, so the other axis looks like this. So this is my axis u tilde, right? And then you can look at what happens if you start on this axis, say, so I start here, and then how my t evolves and how my u evolves. And you will find out that because there is this e to epsilon l, epsilon is now negative, so if I start far from the origin, I actually want to go back to the origin here, right? So similarly, like that, that's what that exponential solution tells me. Right? So epsilon is negative. So no matter where I start with u0, I want to flow into that fixed point. On the other hand, the other one here, t is t0 into 2l. So this exponent is always positive. So I flow away in that direction. So in this direction, in the direction of t, I flow away from that fixed point. So this is on the axis. Of course, if you are not on the axis, it will be something in between. So here, I start here. I probably want to go like this and maybe flow like that. And if I'm here, I may be flowing like that. Okay. One just small remark. We remember that when we discussed this Landau-Ginzburg functional, I told you that u, the coupling constant u, must be positive. Okay? And this is because of the stability and because otherwise it's not well defined and so on. So actually, this part of the diagram where u is negative doesn't really make any physical sense, and you can forget about it. So all that matters is how it behaves for u positive. Okay? That's just a small point. So now, if you look at this picture, because there is one stable direction, if I start here, I am driven to the fixed point. So there's at least one stable direction. The corresponding fixed point is called stable. Okay. So G is called stable fixed point, which means that it is actually there exists at least one direction where it is stable. And in our case, it is this U tilde direction. On the other hand, you see that if I'm on the t-axis, I flow away from the fixed point. So it will be unstable in that direction. But that makes perfectly sense physically, right? So if this fixed point really describes my critical point, it must happen only at t equal to tc, right? Only at t equal to tc I have phase transition. If I am, so about r direction or t direction, it precisely corresponds to temperature direction. So if I start with some other t which is not equal to tc, well, I'm not at a fixed point. I flow away from it, right? So r direction is always unstable. And the reason is that, you know, if I deviate from TC, so it takes me away from critical point. I am not at criticality. So by the way, this is precisely why you call some couplings relevant and some couplings irrelevant. Just a second. So those couplings which actually drive you back to the critical point are called irrelevant, and those couplings which drive you away are called relevant. Okay, so this is relevant direction. And this one is irrelevant. My Gaussian fixed point. Yes?
So is the epsilon bigger than
0 or smaller? So here I'm thinking epsilon smaller than 0. So if you have epsilon smaller than 0, this exponential is decreasing. So if I increase L, this thing actually keep decreasing. So if I start with some non-trivial U0, it drives me back to the.
Is not stable.
Exactly. Yeah. But we'll discuss now. We haven't discussed yet. And so here, well, this is called this fixed point is called mean field theory critical point because it has r equal to 0. Okay. So this is what happens if you are in dimensions which are bigger than 4. Yes? Oh, because the eigenvector vt, if you look at the eigenvector vt, so basically these eigenvectors, they give you new axis where your matrix is diagonal. Okay? So one of them is 1, 0, which is precisely in the r direction, and that's why the t direction is in the r direction. The other one is 1 minus something, that's why I draw that line here. And that gives me my u tilde axis. The questions? Okay, so it's called relevant, this is called irrelevant. Now, what happens if I have epsilon positive? So epsilon is positive, which means d is smaller than 4. Well, if epsilon is positive here, this is positive, this is positive, both these directions drive me away from my critical point, right? So then, the picture approximately looks like this. You have u and r. Again, this is equal to t. And then this is my u tilde. Again, I forget about this thing here because it's unphysical. My critical point is sitting right here. But now both these directions actually drive me away from that point. Okay. So what it means is actually I can never get to that point. Right? So no matter where I start, I always flow away. Right? So I always flow away. So it means that G is unstable. And what it tells me is because G is exactly what mean field theory predicted, it means that mean field theory actually fails below d equal to 4. That's what it tells me. So now you may think, so we had epsilon smaller than zero, epsilon bigger than zero. Last thing is you may think about epsilon equal to zero. And unfortunately, I cannot tell you anything about it because in that case, your coupling is actually marginal coupling. And in order to decide which way it goes, whether it's stable or unstable, you have to go to higher order. So you have to actually consider higher order terms. So epsilon equal to zero, I cannot tell you. But you see that the critical dimension here really emerges about the mean field theory, right? So below four dimensions, I know that mean field theory, because G is unstable, mean field theory has to give, you know, something which is probably wrong. Here, above four dimensions, it gives something which is stable and nice, and that's why it is actually a correct theory. Okay, so that's the proof. Okay, so that was the Gaussian fixed point. Let me very briefly discuss the other fixed point. Why
is the stability of the fixed point related to the mean
field theory? No.
I'm saying this fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point, is the fixed point which is predicted by mean field theory. I know that because it happens exactly at r equal to zero. So that indicates that there's something which is related to mean field theory. So now the stability or instability means basically, can I reach that fixed point or not? If it's unstable, I cannot reach it. If it's stable, I can reach it, and it can correspond to a phase transition. Okay. So very briefly, Wilson-Fisher point. So basically, you do exactly the same thing. You again linearize your beta functions close to this critical point. So you're doing again delta r is equal to r minus r star, delta u equals to u minus u star. But now u star and r star are more complicated because they are not zero, right? They are equal to something over there. So now if you write down again the matrix M, so to leading order in epsilon. Again, do it with your mathematical order in epsilon. I have that M equals to 2 minus epsilon over 3 KD 2 lambda square 0 minus epsilon. So that's our matrix. Again, first rule applies, find eigenvalues, eigenvectors. So lambda t equals to 2 minus epsilon over 3. The other one is over here. It's minus epsilon. Corresponding vectors, 1, 0. And the u tilde equals to 1 minus 4. Over 3, 3 plus epsilon, lambda square, kd. Okay, so these are my directions. So I can again, you know, analyze what happens in the case when epsilon is bigger than 0 and epsilon is smaller than 0. So first, epsilon is bigger than 0, d is smaller than 4. So I wonder if the So this is, these are my values of R star and U star for my Wilson Fisher point. So if you look at, well, epsilon is now bigger than zero, so this thing is negative, and this thing is positive. Okay. So what it means is that my Wilson Fisher fixed point actually is somewhere here. Right? It's negative and positive. So this is U star, and this is R star. Okay. So now again, I have principal directions, which is one of them is like that. The other one is like that. That's my U tilde axis. This is my T axis. So now epsilon is positive, meaning that this guy is negative. So actually, it will be stable in this direction. So it will be stable here. If I take, let's say, epsilon equal to 1, I'm in three dimensions, this is positive. So that will drive me away, as it must. So it will look like this in the vicinity. Again, I have flow like this. But you see that the point, again, has one fixed, one stable direction there. So Wilson-Fisher point is actually stable if you are in, so Wilson-Fisher is stable because it has one stable direction if you are in d smaller than 4. Okay? That's what matters. So now, similarly, if you consider epsilon smaller than 0, then if you look at these values here, then, well, this is something positive. And if epsilon is smaller than 0, this is something negative. So I have u negative, which we know it's unphysical. So actually, Wilson-Fisher point for epsilon smaller than 0 or d bigger than 4 is actually unphysical because u star is negative. So I'm done with the analysis there. Okay, so this is pretty simple, right? So now, great summary of this. Question? No? So far, I have analyzed these two points separately, the Gaussian and Wilson-Fisher fixed points separately. But we have to put all the information together now, right? So summary. And let me consider first the point, the epsilon bigger than 0, so d smaller than 4. So in this case, I have both. I have both fixed points are physical and whatever. So this is my phase diagram. I have u, and I have r equal to t. So I have one fixed point here, which is my Gaussian fixed point. I have another fixed point here, which is my Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So now the axis goes like this. The axis goes like that. So you know that both of these points are unstable in the r direction. So you have this flow here, that flow here, this flow here, this flow here. And you know that the Gaussian point for d smaller than 4 is actually unstable. So everything flows away from it. And actually, it flows to my Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay. So this is my phase diagram. So now if you look at this phase diagram or whatever, so what is happening in this diagram? So again, this part is unphysical, and I don't care about that, right? So I have this very, very special line, this one here, which sort of separates my space of couplings into two parts, on the left side and on the right side, right? So whatever is on the right-hand side, if I start here, I always flow away in that direction there. I can never go to the left-hand side. If I am here, on the other hand, I flow away to the left side. If I am on the line, no matter where on the line I am, I always end up in my Wilson-Fisher point. Okay? So what it means is actually the whole line here corresponds to my criticality. So no matter where I start, I end up in my Wilson-Fisher point, which is the only stable fixed point I have. So this line corresponds to a critical point. So the whole line corresponds to that. And it's the Wilson-Fisher point, which is the right one for d smaller than 4. Okay, so that's why the fluctuations are more important. That's why the mean field theory fails, because this is not the right fixed point. This is the right fixed point. Okay, if I am on the left-hand side, I flow to temperatures which are eventually 0. So here, I have the ferromagnetic phase here. And here, on the right-hand side, I have the paramagnetic phase. And these two are separated by this line, which flows to my Wilson. Okay, so this is the situation in epsilon bigger than 0. And this is where the Nobel Prize actually was awarded for. So it's really to show that the mean field theory fails here. And this is the right thing to consider. And it happens for temperatures which are smaller than the one predicted by mean field theory due to fluctuations, and so on. So now, if you are an epsilon smaller than 0, you already know the result. So, or d bigger than 4, u and r, then you know that the only fixed point you have is the Gaussian fixed point, because Wilson-Fisher doesn't exist. It's 4 negative u, right? And now it's actually a stable one. So this is my stable direction here. So here, this line will actually separate my space into two things. Everything which is on the right-hand side flows there. Everything which is on the left-hand side flows there. So I have ferromagnetic phase here, paramagnetic phase on the right. And this corresponds to my critical point. And you see, because this is the Gaussian fixed point at r equal to 0, mean field theory is actually correct. So mean field theory is OK in d bigger than 4. Isn't this beautiful? And it gets even better. So we have last 20 minutes. So now let's triumph and let's calculate the correct critical exponents from here. Okay, but this is the analysis which you are basically asked to do in your homework for slightly different system. But all it amounts to is actually calculate basically the matrix, which is like linearize my beta functions, calculate the matrix, calculate the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Once you know them, you actually know how the phase diagram looks like. And it tells you which is the right critical point, what's really happening with the system. Okay. So very good. Uh-oh. So this was section 6, was it? So section 7, critical exponents. And I wonder if I deleted what I needed. I deleted everything. OK. And let's call it really a triumph. OK. So let me remind you all the facts which we learned during the renormalization. So we know that close to our critical point, And then you can think about this, you know, the parameter L, which we are using, it's like a time along which our constants flow. So at given L, our constants will be here. At later L, let's say at given L here, later L here, and later L here, and so on. So it's really, you can think about like flow in time, L. So at critical point under RG flow in time L, what happens? So first thing that happens is that the momentum gets changed, right? So this is what's happening, which means that correspondingly, the distances are getting bigger and bigger, right? X over beta, and this beta is just e to the L, right? That's first thing that happens. Second thing that happens is that our wave function gets renormalized, our field gets renormalized, okay? So we know how it gets renormalized in the momentum space. Now it takes one line to see how it gets renormalized in the position space, okay? So you have that phi tilde x tilde is given by dd k tilde 2 pi to power t. That's my Fourier transform. Okay, so now because k tilde changes in this way and x tilde changes in that way, of course k times x doesn't change, so it'll be just k times x. And this guy changes according to what we derived in our renormalization process, okay? So this will be equal to 2 pi power t. So now each k tilde will give me one beta, so it'll be beta to power d. And then my wave function, the normalization, gives me also some power of beta. So if you look at your notes, this is precisely what happens. What's your wave function, the normalization thing here? And e to k times x. So this is my wave function, the normalization. And this just comes from the measure. So in other words, this is equal to beta to t minus 2 plus eta over 2 phi small x. Or let's just forget about smaller. It's just phi x. OK, so if I know how my wave function changes in momentum, I know how it changes in the position. Okay, so that's the second fact I know. And the last fact I know is that how my couplings evolve close to the critical point. So couplings T and U, if you want, evolve. So here I just linearized around the critical point as precisely as we did according to this thing and the other one, tilde equals to u e lambda u times l. So this is all we know, right? We're just gathering all the pieces of information which we learn during the process. Who is with me? Two people, perfect. I'm looking at you. Okay, so very good. So this. It's just, you know, putting everything together. So now let's calculate some critical exponents out of this. So let's start with my critical exponent eta, which is the anomalous dimension. And for that, you need to know what the correlation function is, right? So correlation function so in the position space, so we had gi, j, and so on, but let's do it continuously. So gx, and it corresponds to phi x. I'm just too lazy to do xi minus xj or whatever, so I just put one in 0. So it's phi x minus phi 0, phi x, and then phi 0. Okay, so that's definition of my correlation function. So what do we know about this? Of course, my correlation function is not only function, so it's function of x for given couplings, t and u. But I can understand, so for different couplings, t and u, it will be different. So it is actually a function of all things, of x, t, and u. Okay, so now I look at what happens at x tilde, t tilde, and u tilde. Okay. But I know how x tilde, t tilde, and u tilde look like, right? So this is equal to x over beta t e to lambda t times l and u e to lambda u times l. Okay. So that's first thing I know. And the second thing, you just look at the definition of what g is, right? And you see that it is quadratic in the field. It's quadratic in the field. So it means that actually, you know, each field transforms like this under my Archiff rule. So now it's quadratic in that. So I'll just have this is equal to beta to t minus 2 plus eta times g x t and u. Right, just from the definition here. It's quadratic in that I know that my phi changes according to this. This must be true. Okay. So this is perfect. So it's better to actually write g, x, t, and u equals to something. So let's do it. So g, x, t, and u equals to, now I put the factor on the other side. So it's beta to minus t plus 2, t minus 2. Plus eta g x over beta t e lambda t l u e lambda u l. This looks like our scaling things, which we used in one of our tutorials, right? So this is precisely. Basically, we have shown that the Williams scaling hypothesis follows from RG, at least in our approximation. Okay, so this is beautiful, isn't it? Just come from there. Maybe I can even write it here. So now, let's look at, so like, look in particular at, well, we have, let's say, a fixed point. So we have fixed point at t equal to 0 and u equal to 0. Right? So let's look at that. So we have g, x, 0, and 0. Right? And this is beta to minus t minus 2 plus eta times g x over beta 0 and 0. So that's our equation. Anybody can tell me a solution of this equation? So I have g of x is some power g of x over beta. It tells you that g is actually proportional to x to some power, right? So in other words, if you think about this power, it tells you that this is proportional to 1 over x to t minus 2 plus eta at a critical point. So if you compare with our definition of eta of anomalous dimension, if you've seen before, you know that this eta actually is anomalous dimension as we defined it before. So eta is anomalous dimension from before. Okay, so we were actually consistent to say that eta, as we defined it in our normalization process, actually is eta known from the critical exponent. How did you get the last relation? Oh, so you just think about it very hard. So you say, well, g of x equals to some power times g of x over beta. You are trying to solve which type of equation solves this the equation I'm getting. And the answer is it's 1 over x to some power. And you can just fit the power by looking at this thing. It's like how you know that it must be a homogeneous function in x, and this is the solution. Just give it to a mathematician, to your friend mathematician, and then he will tell you this is immediately that. Right? So there's no other way to satisfy this equation. Okay. I have 10 minutes, which is perfect. So by the way, if you remember, in our approximation, we've shown that that eta was equal to 0 to our approximation. So we have shown that actually, to second order, the anomalous dimension actually is equal to 0. So we have calculated our first critical exponent, and it's equal to 0. OK, so that's good. So the second step is let's move away from critical point in t direction. So it means that I'm choosing g, x, t, but I still keep u equal to 0, g, x, t equal to 0. So now this is equal to beta to minus d minus 2 plus eta. And then whatever I'm getting there, g x over beta t e. OK, so with t, well, times l. But e times l, well, e to l, I define to be beta. Right, so this is actually t times beta to lambda t, right? Okay. So this is definitely true from my scaling relation. And of course, this scaling relation must be true for any beta. So now this is really sneaky trick. So anyway, so this is holds for any beta. So I fix my x, I fix my t, but this must be true for any beta. Okay. So in particular, and this is the sneaky trick, you can choose beta equal to x. So remember, x is fixed here, and t is fixed. So if you choose beta equal to x, well, you can do it, right? Why not? Okay. So what do we have? So from here, we know that g x t 0 equals to now x to minus this thing here. And then I have g. This is now 1. And t to x lambda t. and 0. This is very sneaky, right? Okay, so this is what it is. So now you know that in order to compare this to your traditional correlation function, you know that the traditional correlation function is some function of x over psi, where psi is your correlation length, divided by x to some power, right? So that's our definition. So if this were true, so this is my x to some power. So in order to compare this with the original form of the function, this must be some function of x over psi, where psi is my correlation length, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't match with whatever I had before. Right, so I must have, before I had just exponential, it doesn't matter, it will be exponential, but exponential x over psi divided by x to some power. Okay, so this is what I want. Well, this is only possible if this is a function of x over psi to some power. Right, so from here, you know that your correlation length must be proportional to t to minus 1 over lambda t. So if psi, so okay, so this is x over t to some power, so t to lambda t, and that must be my psi. So this is the solution. Okay. But you know that at the same time, this must be proportional to t to minus nu. Right, so from here, you know that my second critical exponent nu is actually 1 over lambda t. So your eigenvalue of your matrix gives you a critical exponent. Yes?
How can we be sure that this will be an exponential, the f or the
t? Oh, well, I don't even require that it's an exponential here. I'm just saying it must be some function of x over psi. Right, and this I require because I know that, well, gx must be something like a to x over psi and to x to some power. So I already have x to some power. So now, yeah. So from here, you know that nu is 1 over lambda t. So in other words, we know what lambda t is, 2 minus epsilon over 3, that's what we calculated, which is 1 half plus epsilon over 12. Okay, so now we can go to, let's say, 3D Ising model. So for example, 3D Ising, which means that epsilon equals to 1. Then you find a nu is actually 7 over 12, which is something like 0.58. So that's your prediction to the first order, if you want. So now reality is slightly different, but not that much different. It's 0.63. So this is what is actually true. This is what you predicted now. So you are still off, but not very much off. So now I don't have time to calculate other critical exponents, but you will do it in tutorial today. And you will find that the most remarkable coincidence is actually for beta critical exponent, where the prediction is actually 0.33 and the measured value is 0.325. Okay, so it's actually very, very accurate prediction of this thing. Very good. So let me you know, stop here. So I hope that I'll convince you that RG is actually a very powerful tool when you deal with critical phenomena. And you know, it allows you to analytically calculate the critical exponents. It also tells you, predicts the universality of continuous phase transitions. It is much more powerful. It even tells you that all the approximations which you do in condensed matter physics, for example, most of the time you model your systems like non-interacting electrons and so on. Actually, it justifies all these steps. Basically, it tells you that, in certain cases, I can really do non-interacting things. I have really like mean field theory approximations. Sometimes I don't, and so on. And of course, this can be generalized to other models, not only Ising model. You can do any model, and it will be your homework. So let me stop here. And now you have your meeting with our committee. Well, thank you.
Hey.